This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, the Lazarus Effect. Back from the dead. Again. So we've talked about character death before.
We have.
So now we're going to talk about character resurrection, because it happens quite a lot in speculative fiction.
Yes, and particularly it happens a lot in TV, and it happens a lot in series.
Yes.
Where, especially series that go on for longer than they were actually supposed to be going on for. Not naming any names, but, you know, it's a common thing. I think actually possibly one of the good places to start is a character whose literal kind of one of his main characteristics is the fact that he does resurrect, and that's Doctor Who.
Yeah, and you can compare that with Torchwood as well.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about Doctor Who is that the first time he resurrected, people had no idea what was going on. You know, it shocked everyone. But now there's a kind of an expectation for him to sort of resurrect. And the idea is that every time he resurrects, he's actually a little bit different. He is a different person. So you still get this sense of loss because part of him is lost.
Yeah. And I think perhaps when David Tennant left Doctor Who, and you had that The Last of the Time Lords episode.
Yeah.
And everybody was really quite emotional about it, including David Tennant, because you could see him saying, I don't want to leave, because he knows he's not going to be the same person. But also yeah. The actor's saying, I don't really want to leave, because you've kind of been like family.
Yeah. And it was a big thing for him. And it's an interesting thing, because usually the resurrection stuff can sort of have a disappointing element to it, because it's a little bit like, if it happens too often, then you kind of stop being scared for people. Yeah. Because there's no longer this sense of it's forever when people die. Whereas when the Doctor resurrects, there is an element of it's forever, because yes, the Doctor is coming back, but the character you know and love, he's not. It'll be a new character that you may well come to know and love in exactly the same way, but he will be a different character. He's not going to be the same person.
Yeah, that is genuinely something, isn't it? Because the configuration of what makes him the Doctor is slightly different, as you say, each time.
Yeah.
And they've addressed that really well, I think, in the more recent episodes, no matter what you think about recent Doctor Who, where you've had, say, Clara Oswin trying to come to terms with the fact that her Doctor is now not her Doctor anymore.
Yeah.
And because the companions tend to have quite a close relationship with the Doctor, whether it's romantic or not, it's almost a romantic friendship in a lot of ways. And to suddenly have your best friend taken away and a supposed imposter put in their place who says they're the same person, which they are essentially, but they're also not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, I think they addressed it very well the first time when Christopher Eggleston's Doctor turned into David Tennant's for the first time, and you had Rose, who really didn't kind of know what was going on or who this person was, you know.
Yeah.
And she really wasn't sure, and she kind of did feel like she'd lost him forever.
This is where we teeter on the generation gap, because when I say recent Doctor Who, I mean everything from Christopher Eccleston upwards. An old Doctor Who is everything I watched from like 2 years old. Which is a lot. I've accrued a lot of Doctors in my life, let's be fair.
In my day. Sorry.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid it is a bit of that. But yeah, no, I agree with that. Every time they've had to do it, it's something that sort of got skipped over a bit in the original series, I think.
Yeah.
But they have addressed it quite well.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, they've shown that he is a bit different. He is a different person. And that's actually really important, I think, to demonstrate that. Because we deserve to mourn characters. We deserve the chance to mourn them. And I feel like we do now get that chance to mourn them, whereas we might not have in the past in quite the same sort of way. This feels quite authentic.
Yeah.
Because the loss is there, even if it's a different kind of loss. And actually, interestingly enough, talking about loss and sort of resurrection, when a character is changed fundamentally, we can mourn that as well, you know. So I think it comes when a character is exactly the same that they were before and they're brought back. And it's a little bit sort of, we feel cheated because we've felt something. And then the threat kind of goes and the excitement kind of goes with it because it no longer feels real. And in some ways, we no longer feel like we can totally associate with these people because suddenly they're not facing the same kind of things that we in life do.
Yeah, I think there's an element to that. I read something really interesting today on the transformative arc of characters. Mm-hmm. And obviously the transformative arc is not what's going on in the exterior plot, but it's what's going on internally with a character. And a good story means that something internal, integral to the character is changing. They're not the same person at the end of one book that they were at the beginning, generally. Yeah. Often the external conflict mirrors the internal conflict or is linked to it in a way where they have to go through the internal conflict in order to deal with the external conflict.
Yeah.
And that's how you get probably the best, most gripping stories, the ones that stay with you, the ones that you're still thinking about 3 months later or whatever.
Yeah.
But you can boil, the hypothesis is, you can boil all of those questions down to death versus life is what it comes down to. And I think there's some real legs on that theory, because nothing in nature is static. Everything at every moment, if it's alive, is either growing, developing and forming, or it's going towards entropy and disintegrating and becoming dead. You know, it's doing one of those two things.
You're a ball of laughs.
Find that really reassuring. How can you not find that reassuring? Everything in the universe has its place, and
growing
it's
or we're
thing.
Dying.
Exactly.
No between.
Isn't that wonderful?
My God, Jules.
Okay, but going back to the transformative arc, with that in mind, it can be something like, oh, you know, in Pretty in Pink, I don't know if you've ever seen that film, and personally I don't like it, it's just popped into my head. But the main character going to get over the fact that she's got a massive chip on her shoulder, that she comes from quite a poor background, and go out with the guy who is kind of her dream guy, even though he's like a rich football playing type.
Yeah.
And, you know, his transformative arc is, can he get over being teased by his friends enough and become a whole enough person to ask out the girl who's not popular and has quite a chip on her shoulder kind of thing?
Yeah.
Now it is life and death, even though it's not literally life and death, because it has to be the death of their old selves.
Yeah.
So it's a choice between staying their old selves and basically dying as characters. We've all known people who've pretty much ceased to exist before they finally died, and I don't mean that from having a long illness or whatever, but they've just literally given up on life.
I think an excellent example of that is in Pride and Prejudice, where Lizzie's friend marries Mr. Collins.
Oh, Charlotte Lucas, yeah.
Yes, Charlotte Lucas marries Mr. Collins because it's a good prospect for her. But in doing so, she sacrifices basically a part of who she is in order to have that kind of comfort.
Yeah, that's the... I mean, she does say, obviously, I'm not romantic and I never have been. I don't believe that you marry for love because it's not practical. But you're right, she's given up on that part of herself. So that is a character death in a way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And obviously it can be actual life and death, because sometimes if you take something like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, for example,
mm-hmm.
the main character gets lobotomized and dies at the end, but he has a successful transformative arc because he doesn't just lie down under it all. He challenges the system, and another character, the chief, I think he's called, manages mm-hmm. to escape while this guy's being lobotomized. So it is a success.
Is that what Sucker Punch is based off of?
I don't think it's based off it, but
same ending.
The lobotomy type thing comes in there.
And someone else escapes.
So what, you know, having talked about death of either death of part of themselves or death of the actual character, when you then resurrect a character a couple of books later, or, you know, 3 pages later, or, you know, if you're Sarah J. Maas, 3 paragraphs later, what you're doing is you are removing the value of death from the equation. And whether you like it or not, death does have a specific value. Life would not be worth very much if you didn't have death there sat right next to it.
Yeah. So,
that's my theory. And I think that's really cheerful, but apparently I'm just on a big downer. I've lost Madeline now.
You are not letting the Sarah J. Maas thing go, are you?
I can't let it go. I can't, it's still there.
So angry.
anger. If it was anger, I could put it towards something useful. It's more kind of like she's irritated me. It's like a rash.
Jesus, Jules.
In all fairness, though, just looking at it logically, if you're just going to resurrect somebody three paragraphs later, why did you bother killing them, honestly?
Parallels. Literally, parallels. That's it. And the thing is, actually, I wouldn't have minded it. It's at the end of the day, I was going, yay, because everyone was alive. And I guess in some ways it was acceptable because we knew that that was the end, going to be the end of Feyre and, Jesus, I almost called him Tamlin there, Rhysand's character arc, you know. So there was an end to that, that even though they died, they got their happy ending and that was that, you know. If I then, I know that there's going to be other stories, but that they're going to be focused on other people. If I knew it was going to be from their point of view, I might be a little bit sort of like, okay, but it's not. So I kind of accepted it. I felt a little bit cheated by Amran's return, to be honest.
Yeah, that's another one where I think it should have been actual death because it removes the value once again.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's hard to tell because it was for a mixture for me because I got my happy ending and I wanted my happy ending and I didn't want the bittersweet rubbish. I didn't want to be dealing with that. I just wanted... a happy ending and that was that and that's what I got, so I'm not going to complain. But at the same time, yeah, book wise we were cheated a little bit in that respect.
But going back to, you know, resurrection and what value mm-hmm. does it add, if any, I think there's an argument for saying, certainly with television series at least, that it does add some value because the sort of trauma that you can imagine a character having from having died and then come back and having to deal with real life again is perhaps something you can't capture in any other way, particularly if you send them to a hell dimension or to heaven or something like that.
Yeah.
So Supernatural and Buffy are probably the two prime examples for that one.
Well, yeah, and interestingly enough, the first time that I think it was Dean was the first one who ever got resurrected, he was really struggling dealing with it. He was struggling dealing with it because not only was he resurrected, his father died in the process. And his father made a deal with the person, their arch enemy. So you can understand why actually he was so upset and he really kind of wished he had died. So he starts acting in a very kind of reckless way. And then, of course, the next time he'd been to hell.
Yeah, proper Christian hell. For anyone who doesn't watch Supernatural, by the way.
Proper tortured for literal years. He was only dead for a small amount of time, but it felt like years to him. So that wasn't fun. So he came back changed, but at the same time, not really... Like, it gets to a point where they both died a lot now, and so we're not really worried about them dying anymore.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. That's a card you only play a certain number of times, and perhaps Supernatural have overdone it. Whereas if you take Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the first time she dies, the Master kills her. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, she is technically dead. But, you know, she gets resuscitated by Xander. Mm-hmm. She drowned. She didn't just get her neck snapped or anything like that.
Yeah.
Which was lucky for her. But the trauma of that, the fact that it really hit home, and you know, it brought home the horrible life and death job she couldn't quit.
Yeah.
In a way that nothing else has before. Because when you're 16... generally you're not thinking about death in the same way.
No.
Something has to happen to really hammer it home to you, and I think they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing because she died, but it was dealt with in a way so that she wasn't dead for a very long time. She was killed in a way where resuscitation, but yeah, it was, I think that was quite cleverly done.
Yeah, and then of course she dies the second time and it's different because that time she has the agency, she has the power in her hands, she makes the choice to sacrifice herself for her sister. So it's not a case of something's been taken from her, she's offering it. It's her gift, it's her privilege to die for her sister. Mm-hmm. The problems come in when, you know, her well-meaning friends bring her back from the dead, and she wasn't actually trapped in a hell dimension, she was finished, she was in heaven, and she has real difficulty reassimilating.
Yeah. Which I can kind of understand. And interestingly enough, they, going back to Supernatural, they in recent seasons, they brought back the mother, who I think was in heaven.
I haven't seen the last couple of seasons, I don't think. So I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, they brought back the mother who was in heaven, and she was in heaven with basically her husband, and what she basically saw as her two young children. And she's brought back, and suddenly she has these two children who are both adults and have grown up without her. And she's suddenly in this world which has rapidly changed from the one that she remembers. And she finds out that her husband is dead and that he went into hunting and all these horrible things. And then she's basically just sort of like, you have to be a parent now to these two adults who are calling you mum. And, you know, they are her children, but they're not actually her children. Because... Yeah. Her children are the ones that she left in heaven, the young children that she had and that she remembers, and these two are just two grown men who really kind of don't, you know, and that, I think that they did, of all the resurrections they've done in Supernatural, I felt like that one was probably done in a very decent way.
Yeah.
I could understand why she was struggling so much with sort of coming back and kind of almost really wanting to be dead again, to be honest, because you didn't belong there.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? You, if you're going to resurrect a character, then you have to either maintain the value of a physical death so that it is still something to fear, or mm-hmm. something to avoid at the very least, or you have to put a greater death card on the table, and that can be death of self, the death of the person you used to be.
Yeah,
you're so messed up from having been resurrected. All the stories, you know, the previous stories of zombies, not like The Walking Dead, but things where they brought people back as ghouls, as zombies, as ghosts and things, they always come back just a little bit wrong, and something goes horribly wrong with it.
And they usually start eating people, and it's awkward for everyone.
Sometimes they start eating people. But I think that's the thing, isn't it? There's this old... I think it was actually written in a grimoire where you say you shall not seek out the dead. And the reason for this is they don't come back quite right. They're not really meant to be here anymore.
Yep. And I do kind of like that in that this is... I'm going to go a little bit dark here for a second. I went through a period of having a lot of dreams about bringing my mother back to life. That sounds really odd, but I did. And in one, my ultra-Catholic mother was there and she was helping with the proceeds. And we were talking with a bunch of Egyptian, like old, old mythology Egyptian priests who were all wearing animal masks and stuff like that, who were going to use kind of ancient Egyptian magic to bring back the dead. And we hadn't told my dad about it because we just thought... we'll tell him afterwards. Surprise! And so we brought her back, and you know, there she was, and she was awake, and I ran to her and I threw my arms around her, and even as I was, you know, sort of so glad to see her again, something in my head was going, oh no, we've done something bad. We've done something very bad. I'm going to hell. I'm definitely going to hell.
Yeah.
And then the following night, I had a dream where my dad was the one, and I was just there like, wait, you brought mum back from the dead? And he was there like, yes, I did, and don't worry, it's totally fine. And I was like, okay, I'm not sure it is, but all right.
It is something that, and I know we do talk about Harry Potter a fair bit, but I think it's quite valid for this one. Harry Potter touches on it with the Resurrection Stone, the second Deathly Hallow, and the ghosts who come back when you turn the Resurrection Stone aren't like the ghosts that just exist generally in Harry Potter, as in they've got no choice, they're pulled back, but they also don't really belong anymore. And I think the idea is that you could waste your life away trying to communicate with people who can never touch you.
Yeah, and who also, this is another thing, is that how unbelievably selfish it is, because they can't interact with the world as a living being either. You know?
Yeah.
They can only be a ghost in it. And that's not their choice. You know, even ghosts can interact with the world in a certain way. But yeah, the part of the Resurrection Stone is that they pine and they disappear because they don't belong there.
Yeah. And there's something disquieting about that. But it's one of the themes that J.K. Rowling does follow a lot in the series of Harry Potter, which is death. And you know, perhaps there are far greater evils than death, and perhaps the thing you should be doing is learning to let go. That fits into it very well. And then you look at, of course, that same scene with Harry. he knows he's walking to his death, and he does effectively die.
Yes, he does.
And obviously comes back because of how Voldemort's very complex Horcrux set up. He wouldn't have. The thing to mention here, obviously, is that if you bother following the plot, it's not a case of Harry was never in any danger throughout the books. If Voldemort actually killed him, then Voldemort would he'd come back because Voldemort would be destroying the part of his soul that Harry was carrying. If anyone else tried to kill him, he'd just be dead.
Yeah, you
know, that would be it.
Super dead. Yeah. So it's a good thing that Voldemort was all obsessed about killing him himself.
Just as a little sidebar there. But I think it is important because Harry doesn't know that. He walks into that willingly, knowing that he's going to die, believing he's going to die. The fact he comes back and then fights Voldemort, he's not absolutely certain. It's just at that point, death doesn't hold the same amount of fear because he's been there and actually it's not as bad as he thought it was.
Yeah.
Or at least the little bit he's seen. But I don't think that ever takes away anything from his own bravery at the end there.
Yeah. And there's also an interesting bit, which is that he's given the option about actually whether to go on or to stay.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting because, again, it's in some ways, it's not a complete resurrection because he comes back, you know, himself. It was actually kind of in part a decision that he himself made, not that someone made on his part.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. He resurrected himself, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, neither can live while the other survives kind of thing, isn't it? It's the whole Voldemort bound them together. So the only way one of them could die was if they basically killed themselves.
Yeah.
Ultimately, which is what Voldemort did. So yeah, it was cleverly done, and obviously he was bound there, but the idea that he had some choice over the matter was definitely interesting. And as a little sidestep here, let's talk about near-death experiences.
Okay.
Which I've never had. But my grands used to come and stay at Christmas when we were little, and generally we'd all three of us girls would pile into one room. We had bunk beds and a drawer. The drawer pulled out. We put Ella in the drawer. She was the little one.
I'm sure she enjoyed that.
No, there was actually a mattress in the drawer. We didn't just shove her under the bed.
Shove her in her drawer. In you go!
I'm glad we don't do this anymore because I'd be the little one and I'd get shoved under the bed. Moving on from that, our grandmothers used to stay in either mine or Sarah's room, depending on who got there first. My dad's mum, who I haven't spoken about as much, but she had some interesting ghost stories too. See, I was doomed. I was doomed from the very beginning.
You were.
But one Christmas Eve, she was sleeping in my room, and Mum had to call out a doctor for her because she'd been taken very, very ill in the night. And, you know, she wasn't in the best of health for the latter end of her life. She was much older than my other grandmother as well. Mm. And she very nearly died in my bed on Christmas Eve, which is, you know, a special kind of that'll stay with you when you're about 12 or 13. Just want to point that out.
Yes.
But I remember her saying that, you know, there's whatever you think of near-death experiences, it's interesting that the brain, which then releases basically lots of opiates to make it comfortable as you're passing away. It's funny how the brain, which is a modelling system and generally interprets things in different ways, seems to interpret this in pretty much the same way in almost all cases of near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a rushing tunnel with a light at the end of it and a sense that they're drifting further and further away from their own bodies. I just find it really interesting that that most people think the same thing. And my gran described this exact same incident, and she said the only thing that kept her there was the fact that my mum kept calling to her, so every time she started to drift away, she got pulled back by my mum. Anyway, she got taken into the, you know, doctor came out, and she got taken into hospital, and she was okay, and she obviously lived for about another 10, 12 years, something like that, after that.
Gosh. But good honour.
She did say at the time, you know, I would have died that night. And then a bit later on in life, she said rather bitterly, I was supposed to die that night. You kept calling me back.
Christ.
But I suppose what I'm getting at is the idea that why is there this commonality of experience? Because we produce brain chemicals in a slightly different way. We understand input to our brains in a slightly different way. So why, given those two things, which already give you huge variables, why with near-death experiences do people have pretty much the same visionary experience as they, you know, pop their clogs? I'm not expecting an answer. I'm just like, isn't it interesting?
No, I'm going to say that the guild made me promise not to tell anyone. So.
Was that before or after you tried illegal resurrections?
I have never tried a resurrection spell. I will have you know. There are some things that even I know are a terrible idea. I've watched Full Metal Alchemist.
So just to tie that back to Harry Potter, there's a lovely bit where Harry says to Dumbledore, is this all in my head? And Dumbledore says, yes, but why should that mean that it's not real? And I'm paraphrasing. And there's a good point there, because it might be that Voldemort hit him with the Avada Kedavra curse and Harry's brain just went wee and produced loads of basically morphine so that he wouldn't be in pain as he died. And he just hallucinated Dumbledore, which is, you know, quite creative. But it doesn't mean that your brain in those last moments isn't actually producing something that's worth remembering.
I'm sorry, I'm still stuck over the idea that Harry gets killed and his brain's automatic reaction is to go wee and basically drug him.
Yeah, but that's what everybody's brain does.
Yeah, I love that dopamine. So, you're quite right. And I do like the way that it was done, actually. That is quite a satisfactory resurrection. I guess in a lot of ways you don't really think of it as a resurrection, but it is. It is a resurrection character. And I think actually, again, the thing I really like about it is the fact that it was his choice. He resurrected himself.
Yeah.
And that's quite fun. Say fun. Da, da, da.
Fun.
You know what I'm going to do today? Sorry.
Nope. That's fine. Anyway, other resurrections. I mean, that, you wonder where the whole resurrection myth comes from, really, because is it Christian? Is it pre-Christian? I think it probably goes back a really, really long way. It probably goes back as far as we started telling stories to each other when we were living in caves.
Oh, yeah. I'm almost certain of that as well. Resurrection myth is... the idea of a form of life after death is very, very old, and very often actually that form of life didn't actually mean it involved a new kind of life, a new sort of resurrection. And then obviously in a lot of cultures, resurrection as in actual resurrection is a thing. You know, when I am reborn, I will be a bird or a tiger or another human, or, you know, as part of a lot of several religious beliefs.
Yes. Or I'll be gloating down at you from a, you know, a heavenly plane, depending on your religious beliefs. But no, a physical resurrection where somebody actually dies and then comes back within the same lifetime, in the same body.
Yeah.
And I think that those myths must go back. It can't just be a New Testament thing.
Well, no, I don't think it is. And I also think that talking about health for a second, and you know that they used to have sort of bell ringers, in graveyards and stuff like that, because people really didn't understand death,
yeah,
did they? So I mean, is it really a surprise that people might have gone, oh, she's dead, and then the person wakes up and they go, ah, risen from the dead?
I have heard of cases of that. I think that probably happened far less than it is postulating.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying that I just think all it takes is for it to happen once and for people to be telling stories about it then forever.
Yeah, there's certainly a grand tradition among Catholic saints of them being buried and then they disinter them a couple of hundred years later and they're still as fresh as if they were there before. And what that comes down to is, have they been exposed to microbes and worms in the soil?
Yeah.
It's like, but obviously if you don't know about microbes because you can't see them, then obviously it's God's work, isn't it?
Clearly God's work, yeah.
So we've gone on to corpses now.
Very easy to do.
Well, since we're talking about corpses, let's talk about Skullduggery Pleasant.
Yes, let's.
Are you a fan?
I've only just gotten the first book. I haven't started reading it yet.
Oh, it's awesome. You're going to love it.
I know I am. It's just that it's been suggested to me a lot. So.
It is so your sense of humour.
Like to hear.
So I won't spoilify you, obviously, but there are episodes in that where certain characters die and come back to life, but it's all part of the magical world. And, you know, death can be very much an actual thing in Skullduggery Pleasant World, but far more dangerous is the death of yourself, the death of everything you stand for, your morality, your compassion, your courage. You can become something really evil. You can very easily get drawn over to the other side by basically being infected by dark magic.
Yeah.
So that's the scary death in Skullduggery Pleasant. Skullduggery Pleasant himself, who I think is a 17th century gentleman who's always fought on the side of the mages, got hit by a very nasty curse, died, but he was so angry he came back. Unfortunately, he came back without his flesh.
Yeah.
He had to leave something behind, so when he came back, he's a giant, grinning, wisecracking skeleton detective. And he's absolutely awesome, obviously.
These words are all exactly what I want in life.
And yeah, he's just utterly brilliant. But at the same time, when you think about it, there's something incredibly macabre about the whole thing.
I don't really have to think about it that much. Yes, I can confirm that that is incredibly macabre. Doesn't take a lot for me to come to that conclusion.
There's now 10 books in the series. I was lucky enough to get given an arc of the 10th book, which I haven't read yet. I love getting given arcs, it's great. But yeah, it's a 10-book series with a couple of spin-off novels, and the whole thing's really worth reading. Anybody who hasn't tried it, it's so funny and really dark and quite gross. But, you know, all those things just mean it's really up my street.
I'm looking forward to reading it very much. I think it's going to be excellent. And I think it's going to be right up my street. And that, again, that's another very interesting form of resurrection in the terms of Skullduggery Pleasant. And that's that he had to leave something behind. And the thing that he left behind was his flesh. That's fantastically unique.
And, yeah, unique and gross. And it stays with you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I really like that idea, though. That
it plays into this image we have of, like, the ferryman being a giant skeleton, you know, and of death being a skeleton wielding a scythe, which obviously Terry Pratchett presented with his character Death as well.
Yeah.
And I was doing some research on this just by chance. You know when you're doing research for a book and you stumble across something?
Yeah.
And I was doing research for I Hold the Tide because I needed a little bit on something particular in there. Mm-hmm. And this whole thing of the death being presented as a skeleton actually comes from a Cornish Welsh legend of the Ancow. The Ancow mm-hmm. was basically Death's little helper, and he was a skeleton who wore a hood and wheeled a barrow collecting the bodies.
That's very nice of him.
And over time, the two sort of got merged together, and he wasn't so much Death's helper, but Death was presented as a skeleton. I mean, Ancows could also guard graveyards, for example, as well.
Ah. Oh.
So, interesting.
I did not know that. That's brilliant. There you go. Learn something new every day, listeners. Because I always thought that him appearing as a skeleton really sort of got popularized during the plague.
Ah, that is where I think the Ancow myth spread during those years. Obviously, the whole plague thing took place over about 300-400 years altogether.
Yeah.
But there was that original myth, and then obviously when you have so many bodies being collected and someone going around with the barrow, you only need one person to say, oh, the Ancow's out collecting the bodies again, bring out your dead, etc, etc.
Yeah.
And I bet that really caught the imagination, so I can kind of see how that would have gone round.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's really brilliant. I say brilliant, I don't mean it like that.
Well, yeah, love me some giant skeletons.
Love me some giant walking skeletons carrying bodies. No, but that is really, really interesting. Nice piece of mythology.
While we're talking about resurrection,
mm-hmm. She says, reminding me before I get on.
Before we start talking about skeletons even more. We'll do that another episode. We'll do an episode on corpses. And then we'll get sectioned, probably. Sorry. What's worth having a look at is the myth of the resurrected god.
Okay.
And that comes up a lot in various different bits of mythology, and is then pretty much, I wouldn't say pantomimed, but pretty much played out in whether you want to call it myth, fact, or part of a religious tradition of, you know, Jesus of Nazareth.
Yes.
As well. The risen God is a really, really old tradition. It's pre-Celtic, as in you would have the ear king who was cut down with the corn and then was reborn with the holly. And then more of that was played out over the years in various different mythologies. Norse mythology, you have Odin who hangs on Yggdrasil for 9 days and nights. Technically, that was a death. You know, it was a death and he was reborn with wisdom. Or he was certainly reborn with written language anyway. And yeah.
It's definitely an interesting way to learn a new language.
And if you do a bit of delving into the Wiccan tradition and the Golden Dawn, if you've heard of that.
Nope.
Aleister Crowley.
Oh gosh, Crowley, yes.
High magic. Again, there is a ritual point at which the practitioner is supposed to face death in order to ascend to the next level.
Yeah.
In the more strict high magic traditions. Generally, I believe, that has been pantomimed for years.
Mm-hmm.
They don't actually bury people alive anymore. But certainly what it used to be was people were buried alive and they did quite literally face a situation where they could die. I've heard of other traditions where there was a tide mark and a person had to sit there as the tide came in and not move.
Mm.
And if the tide took them, then obviously they weren't worthy and they died. But if the tide didn't take them, they'd face death and death had found them worthy and sent them back out.
It's really dumb.
Yes.
Sorry.
I'm not advocating this for anyone, by the way. I'm just saying it's interesting how this has permeated our various different cultures, actually, to the extent where it became part of a magical and religious tradition.
Yes. Oddly enough, people often forget this, though, that in the Christian Bible, the first person to be resurrected wasn't Jesus. It was Lazarus.
Yes, also known as Simon the Magus.
Goodness, you're full of... You've got all sorts of knowledge today, haven't you?
Well, no, we've just... I did a study on basically ascetic Judaism, Hellenic Judaism, and Gnosticism years and years ago, and all the stuff is just sort of coming back to me. But Lazarus was a Latinized form of Eleazar, which meant the marked one.
Mm-hmm.
And Simon the Magus, if you read... Go, but you really have to page through sort of Herodotus's historical scrolls and bits and pieces, and there's various other bits and pieces as well. But if you piece it together, it looks like Simon the Magus might have really, really upset the ascetic Pharisees, who did not like the Gnostics,
mm-hmm.
and was sentenced to death by burial alive.
Right.
So he was put in a tomb, and a rock was rolled in front. He couldn't get out by himself. And then Jesus came along and said... Yeah, I'm not going to let you die in there. Sort of let him out. That was him resurrecting him.
You're right in there, dude. Nah, all right.
Of course, maybe it did... I don't know this one way or another, but that seems the most likely historical explanation. And if you delve into the Judaic tradition, it makes a lot of sense. And if you delve into early Gnosticism, it also makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of ritual involved. And Simon the Magus had a lot of status.
And they never tried to eat anyone. Well, I mean, did Lazarus try to eat anyone afterwards?
If they did, they hushed it up.
Really hushed it up. So what about resurrections which you have been dissatisfied by?
Sorry, that sounds like such a leading question, doesn't it? Which is talking about Jesus.
Sorry. No, I didn't mean it like...
You've done it better.
No, I thought we were moving away from Jesus.
I'm sorry, my brain's reassociating.
You hear what you want to hear.
We all do. Yeah, well, obviously, I've mentioned A Court of Wings and Ruin.
Yeah.
And I think it was more a case of the value of the death became less valuable. Because it wasn't fully explored, nobody felt in jeopardy. So what did we learn from it, ultimately, is where I'm going there.
Yeah.
Other deaths where I'm just like, they weren't very satisfying. I think if it hasn't actually done anything for the character's transformational arc, it's not explored.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's unsatisfying. If it's just a near miss and someone thinks someone's dead, then it's kind of like, well, you know, at some point all of us might well have thought someone's been hurt or injured and actually they haven't been, so that's okay because that's just life.
Yeah. I guess with A Court of Thorns and Roses, the bit I didn't like is that Rhysin was alive and the first thing he did was sort of pretty much make a joke. And it was just there like, yep, we're good. Whereas when Feyre was brought back, there was a real sense of, oh God, what's happened? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, she did change species.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. It made it slapstick, didn't it? I think it was parody for the sake of parody. And perhaps it was also to give Tamlin just another little chance to be a bit more redeemed.
Yeah, which I think some of our listeners liked. I'm thinking of one in particular.
Yeah, I know who you mean.
So, yeah, we did get that chance, and it was a nice sort of parallel. But yeah, I think that certain ways of resurrection can be quite hard. That being said, so I've read, and so have you, actually. Our listeners will not have, so this next bit, we'll try and keep it short. Amelia McKenzie, who was on last week, we both read her manuscript, Ars Moriendi. And without giving too much away, that does involve resurrection as well. And yet, despite that, death was treated... I like the way she handled it, because... death wasn't treated as death was still serious, but actually the main focus was on the fact that death hurt.
Yeah, it's still a loss. It's still something to be avoided at all costs.
Yeah, and death hurt. It hurt the people who were left behind. It hurt them to see, and then there was the physical matter. Death actually physically hurt.
Yeah,
death physically hurt. And the people who didn't die would have to watch someone they cared about suffering, you know, and they had watched them suffering over and over. They'd seen them die in really horrific ways, and so I liked the way that was done as well, because it added another thing, which is that actually there's a price to sort of living forever and being resurrected and stuff like that, in that especially if you have to face that death, and not only do you have to face it, you have to remember dying. You have to remember the past lives that you had, the potential you can't have, and the restrictions that puts on you. If you're someone who resurrects, then you probably can't have children because they won't resurrect. And then you'll have to live forever having lost them. You have to live forever having never being able to see the friends that you've made, you know?
Yeah.
And issues of identity as well that come with resurrection. So that was actually quite an interesting way that they did it. Well, they did it, that Amelia did it. And I found that was an interesting way of looking at reincarnation and adding the drama to it without having to, by focusing on something entirely different.
Yeah, and I think in some of the better kinds of vampire fiction, usually the path to becoming a vampire is horrific.
Yeah.
Otherwise everybody would be doing it, so it's usually extremely painful, very difficult, you know, fails a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the cognitive dissonance of finding that you're now no longer that person you were before is so extreme that in some cases I think the new vampire sort of self-destruct.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, you're not the person that you were before, and actually you can't ever go back to being that person. You can't go back to the life that you had, especially in the case of whether, you know, you're someone who can't go out in daylight, you're someone who can't enjoy food anymore, who can't be around people, things like that. That's quite serious.
Yeah, and obviously going back to Joss Whedon and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, then you've also got, you're basically losing your morality, your conscience, your soul, the part of you. You're keeping part of yourself and part of your personality, but you're kind of taking a demon on board, which seems like the really absolute worst way of doing it to me.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Seemed like much fun. So, okay, so have there ever been, other than A Court of Wings and Ruin, have you ever had any resurrection stories that you've really just not enjoyed at all?
I can't remember them off the top of my head, which would suggest that they were probably films, and I probably did my thing of deleting it as I was watching it because I wasn't enjoying it.
Fair enough.
It's so weird. I remember books, but if it's a film and I don't like it, then I just start erasing it from my memory as I'm watching it.
Do I have to remember this? No, then I'm not going to. Fair enough. I'm trying to think of resurrections which have disappointed me. Probably it's gonna have to be Supernatural.
Yeah, it got to a point where it was a bit silly. It's kind of like, okay, so you're dead. Where are you at the moment? Oh, right, you're in hell. There's a big surprise.
Yeah, it's just got a little bit. It's just like, just let them lie. And it's not just that. It's the characters, you know, several characters keep being resurrected over and over. And the problem is that the Supernatural, they obviously kill all of their characters. But only if you ever get to really, really come back.
Yeah, you really don't want to be alive in that universe, do you?
No, you really don't. So, yeah, but other than that, I think most of the time, most of the things I've read, they've done the resurrection thing quite well. So not too many complaints, to be honest.
Yes. Anyway, that's probably about all we've got time for. So we'll resurrect this podcast next week.
Sounds good to me. We'll catch you guys next week. Thanks and goodbye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.